Good morning and well, good afternoon and welcome to New Haven, Dateline New Haven, WNHH-FM. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. I got two great guests this morning, people I always love to talk to and get together with. And we're going to talk about the Zoom government era. It's been almost a year now since the pandemic started and local government has moved online. And our two guests today have done the first study I've seen in Connecticut and the first hard look at what this has meant for the way we make decisions as communities, especially about our budgets, and what this is going to mean moving forward when hopefully this pandemic passes. Please say good morning to Southern Connecticut State University Journalism Professor Jody Mosier-Gill and Southern Connecticut State University Political Science Professor Jonathan Wharton. And you folks are welcome to unmute your mics, although I understand Jody wants to keep hers on at times. And folks, thanks for joining us today and telling me about this article you have just been published in the Journal of Civic Information. And that's a journal that has academic papers from all over the country, maybe the world. And it includes an article by these two professors of their study of 95 Connecticut municipalities and how they went about aspirationally democratically approving their budgets this term. And because I guess Jody lives in Seymour, Jonathan used to live in New Haven and was the Republican town chair, they did a special focus on those two communities. So the paper is called Open Budgetary Meetings Amid a Pandemic, Assessing Connecticut's Various Pathways to Public Engagement During COVID-19. Jody, that's a little bit longer than the titles of articles you used to write for newspapers, right? In your journalist days.
It is different. And thanks for having us. We're really excited to talk about it. As you said, I teach journalism and I'm a former reporter. And Jonathan and I teamed up because his expertise is local government. And we thought it'd be interesting to see, you know, what happened during our budget season last spring. So budgets were underway in all of our towns and cities when COVID hit. And suddenly we had these executive orders from the governor saying we couldn't meet in person, we couldn't have town meetings, we couldn't have budget votes. And so in the summer, after all of these budgets were passed, Jonathan and I said, let's look at what happened. What did towns and cities do? How did they shift gears? And more importantly, did the public respond? We were really interested to see, were members of the public more likely to be engaged because they could be doing it from home? Or were they more likely to disengage because you couldn't see people face to face? And we were all kind of, you know, feeling the Zoom fatigue by then. So we did a survey and then we looked at four towns, two of them, Seymour and New Haven, where we've lived. And we did more in-depth interviews as well, just to find out a little bit more about, you know, what did it look like? I want to say on the ground, but really virtually in those towns. So
tell me if I got the takeaway right. And obviously there's a lot to the takeaway. I'm not saying this is all your paper found. You found that in a lot of places, it was about the same level of public engagement. In some places, people were more engaged in the past. In others, but not as many, they were less. Mm-hmm. And that you found that this first year experience gave us some thoughts about how moving forward, we can use tools like Zoom to increase the involvement of people in their local government decisions, even as we also go back face-to-face. Is that a fair?
Yeah, it was mixed. And most towns either saw the same or more engagement, right? And a lot of it came down to, and like with anything, it's more than just because of being online, but a lot of it came down to, were people engaged because of issues in the budget? You know, were we cutting teacher salaries or were we cutting something major that really brought people out? And were people more engaged in some towns because we actually, the towns did a lot more effort to invite them to be engaged, right? It kind of shifted how towns were doing their budget approvals. And so in some cases, towns were really proactive about inviting people to participate where they were always allowed to do so, but maybe they didn't get that like invitation in the past.
You know, that's interesting because we have fun covering all this you know, we had the same wonk endorphins you guys did, that here's this opportunity to see how this works. I know John did for years in both teaching and politics, has talked a lot about using the web creatively to help increase people's participation. So in Hamden, they really couldn't figure out how to do Zoom for a while. And then once they figured it out, then came the Zoom bombing, when people came in and did those disgusting, you know, pornographic, violent images and things had to shut down. So Jody, you brought up a point I hadn't thought about when I read it, was that you have to isolate some factors. So in some cases, communities started out web savvier than others, but also the amount that people participate sometimes has to do with what's at stake. So if New Haven had had a big tax increase on the agenda, more people would have participated, right? And, you know, year two might be more interesting to watch because we're still online and the towns are wrestling with the economic effects, the fiscal effects of this downturn. Did either of you come with a takeaway of where you saw it best? Like, who did it best and why did they do it best?
Well, as a matter of fact, I was about to say, one of the key reasons why we took a look at the case studies was we wanted to see differences between all the towns. I mean, after all, Paul, as you know too well, Connecticut's got 169 municipalities. And we found out, no surprise, they all were doing it so differently. Their budgetary meetings in the past and even in the present with their online. And it's been a lot of trial and error and a lot of lessons learned. As a matter of fact, in the interviews, that Hamden model that you brought up was a concern, certainly in New Haven. I think you know Al Lucas, who helps run the Board of Alders as the chief of staff. He brought that out. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to interview key people, certainly mayors, which we did, and first selectmen and women. And that included, by the way, beyond just New Haven and Seymour, also Fairfield and Guilford. So we did learn a lot from towns, especially Fairfield. Fairfield was amazing, Paul, to get to your point, because they were already experts in many ways early on in terms of doing these meetings online. They had the staff, they were already prepared, they had the software, they learned a lot before even COVID even took place. And so many of the towns are now looking to them. And we also interviewed, no surprise, Joe DeLong from the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities. And he brought that out over and over again, that many of his members are the ones who were learning a lot from what Fairfield learned. And so it's interesting to talk with the first select woman there and how she was so outwardly proud of this, but she admitted, hey, look, we were fortunate that we learned way in advance and we had key software and computer tech people who were savvy on this in advance of everything taking place last year.
Well, Jonathan, you've written about education, about how there was a long overdue push on higher ed to figure out how to use remote tools more creatively for education 21st century. So that's what you found here. So Jody, what I'm interested in is, you did old school reporting at municipal level. You went to community meetings as a reporter. How did democracy look when you went back and saw what it was done remotely? Is it the same thing when people comment online as opposed to showing up at a meeting and talking? Is it better because it's easier for people to participate? Is it worse because there's less human interaction in person?
So the way people commented was different. And so that was something that surprised me, because I imagined the public comments would come like we are doing right here, where we would show our face and talk and it would be more like a real live meeting. But a lot of towns only allowed public comment through email. And some towns only allowed public comment when you spoke. So it really depended on the town. I think in New Haven, they wanted people to speak. They didn't have to show their face, you could call in, but they wanted you to actually speak. Whereas in Guilford, they wanted everybody to email in their comments and they would read them into the record or summarize them some other way. So to answer your question, I was surprised that it didn't look the same. I kind of anticipated, having sat through so many meetings, just seeing people talk. But in a way, I think that actually made more people, or allowed more people to comment, because not everyone wants to stand up in front of, you know, even if it's only 10 people in a room, not everyone is comfortable doing that. And so reminding people that they could email comments, which they could always do, actually, I think, prompted some people to comment when they wouldn't have otherwise commented. The other key thing here is, in Connecticut, there are so many towns and cities that allow residents to vote on their budget. And this year, they weren't allowed to do that in most cases, because we couldn't gather together at that point. We weren't allowing, you know, people to get together in a town meeting or go to the referendum at the polls. And so a lot of people commented because they couldn't vote. And so they're used to having a say, but they don't necessarily have that say at a public meeting. They normally do it, you know, in a vote. This year, or this past year, they felt like they lost that say. So some people were more likely to comment only because they weren't able to vote that year, which I found really interesting.
It is interesting. And Jonathan, do you get a sense that if someone, as Jody says, emails in a comment at a public meeting, does that have the same weight, the same impact as if someone's standing up there face to face? Is it easier for a politician to ignore it the way we're used to seeing 200 comments on a Facebook thread, not just, you know, small group of people are intense? Or is this a way that we really do get more voices, that we have more, do we have more democracy this way, I'm asking?
John. Paul, you know, that's my pet peeve. So you're hitting me in the heart right there, man. You know, I was an advocate certainly for having more of an open comment period, if that were even possible in New Haven. Of course, we know where that went. And of course, we've seen in other cities and towns that they are more open to doing that. And so my biggest fear and concern was how, first, I guess the first thing is, how are people learned on this? So this is the process of this is how they're going about it. Are they in fact learning that you can email or you can have an open comment period? Are they able to send, as you said, a Facebook post? You know, how, what are the ways and methods for them to learn to communicate in this fashion? Because in the past, some towns don't allow an open comment period before a meeting. Other towns do. So that we see inconsistencies before even COVID and the online meetings took place. And now you throw this on top of everything else. It just gets very confusing for so many people. I guess for me, I'm very old school and very much a traditionalist, as you know me, Paul. I'd rather still have it instead of anything in written form for it to be heard and said, because you get to that non-verbal communication element of it, right? We know in meetings and in forums when people are outspoken, and we've mentioned this certainly in our study, the workshops that take place, which Al Lucas and the alders and certainly the mayor loves to see during the budgetary workshop meetings, right? Because we see people who show up, obviously, at Wilbur Cross High School and Hill House, right? And it gets very outspoken. You know this, Paul, you've been on the front lines. You know, I've attended those meetings. And that element is lost in an email. That part of it in a Facebook message is just not the same. And I think this is so critical, especially in this era, in respecting people's participation and involvement in the first place. One thing to also add, Paul, and you know this too well between you and Jody being journalists on the front lines, where are the reporters in all this in terms of covering and having an aspect of a lot of this? Again, a lot of that is lost too with the online meetings. And I am just so concerned about the flavor missing in that in terms of the reporters. Having, you know, a way to cover and have a say and making it known, as well as the constituents too.
So you anticipated one of my questions there, and I want to ask Jody as a reporter. That was one of my frustrations. Like, I found we were able to cover more meetings because folks didn't have to get there at night. They could watch a rerun, but you're not in the room pulling people aside who just spoke and getting their backstory. If a politician doesn't want to explain what she or he did, that person doesn't have to respond to you. Whereas in person, not that you're going to be obnoxious, Jody, you were never obnoxious, but you were able to go up there and say, hey, what'd you mean by that? And it's more likely to get an answer. But on the other hand, people my age are old fogies and communication has changed. So I look at Zoom and I see exactly what Jonathan said, that you don't get the visual cues you get when you're talking to someone in person. There's a delay, like praying is not the same online. Doing this interview is not the same as we're in the studio. So what did you conclude, Jody, as a younger generation journalist who covered meetings? How does this impact the reporting?
I think, just as you both said, there's some pros and some cons, right? If you can't get to, I remember so many nights there were two meetings at the same time, right? Because we covered more than one town. So if I couldn't go to one meeting, I could always look at it later in this forum, right? I could still see the conversation that happened and not have to rely on people to tell me what happened and not have to rely on people to convey like some of the emotion from somebody's comments or their speech. Like you said, though, there is something lost when you're not in the room with somebody. And if you need to hold someone accountable, it really helps to be in person with them. I mean, even just showing up, when they see a reporter in the meeting, they know that you're serious versus just logging on and they can see my icon. It's not as serious. I mean, I could be in the other room and just have my camera muted for all they know, right? When they see me sitting in the front row with my notebook every week and they see the camera come out, they get cues too about what I'm reacting to. And so it's this two-way communication that I feel is really lost with Zoom. It's also weird with Zoom because you're seeing everyone's faces so up close, whereas in the meeting room, you're not. So I think people get a little bit more, they're more natural. Maybe they feel a little bit more comfortable because you're not like right face to face with them at all times. And maybe you get a little bit more authentic talking and conversation in that setting.
Paul, if you don't mind my chiming in on after that, what she said, because I know this will speak to Paul's side of things. The art of smoozing, right? It's kind of a lost art, obviously, through Zoom. And I know, Paul, you're very old school. You're like me. We relish the time where we can go to a meeting or a hearing before and after and discuss things out, right? With officials and reporters and constituents. And yet that's gone. And I really, really miss that secret art. And how can you teach that except for being a part of it?
And we're talking about the future of democracy online and otherwise after our experience of the pandemic with Southern Connecticut State University professors, Jody Mosgill and Jonathan Wharton. They have a new study out that's published in the Journal of Civic Information about what happened at 95 municipal budget proceedings in the past year when cities and towns had to go online rather than in person. Can I read you two sample quotes from your study? One was you quoted a local official saying, "I am conflicted because on the one hand, the number of people participating in the process is significantly higher than when we were meeting in person. On the flip side, it is more impactful to have a person show up to our meeting than it is for me to dispassionately read a letter into the record." Then Al Lucas, who's sort of the institutional memory of New Haven government and is the staff person for the Board of Alders, told you, your report says, Lucas said one change he noticed is that people tended to stay in the meetings longer when they are conducted via Zoom, Jody's point, maybe they run the other room to get a snack, than when they would be held in person. Noting that at the time there was no other live entertainment going on, he suggested it might be connected to residents wanting something to watch in the background, but he also thinks it was just more comfortable for them to be present from home. Quote, it made it a lot easier for residents who have other things to do to be heard. People with family obligations, elder care, or child care issues. You might have to sit here for 4 hours to speak for 3 minutes and your child has to go to school the next day. So this is like everything with the internet. You say, is it better or worse? And you say, that's like saying the weather. It's there. It has pros and cons and we should channel it. So overall, how did democracy do this past year?
Well, I have to say the one thing that I hope stays from this change is the governor required what's essentially proactive disclosure. As part of the budget meetings, towns had to post all their documents online in advance of the meetings. That was never required. A lot of towns already did that, but not everyone had to. And so I think that's a huge win for democracy. If we can see all the documents before the meeting, we can better participate in that meeting. And the fact that that was never required before is actually kind of sad, really, when you think about it, because why shouldn't the public have access to all those public documents? In an easy way, I shouldn't have to like drive to town hall and make a photocopy if I can just get a PDF online. So in that regard, I think that was a big win for democracy. I don't know if that'll be required moving forward. We have yet to see, you know, what rules will be in place this upcoming year, but I'd like to see that required for all meetings, you know, moving forward, even post-COVID.
Great, and what about post-COVID in terms of whether people can type in questions, speak online? Do you think we should continue holding meetings only online? Should we have a hybrid where they're online and people can speak in person first and then go online? Or will that take all night? And should we just go back the old way with improvements like Jody's mentioning of getting those materials out to people?
I think it really depends on the jurisdiction. And as a matter of fact, we offered that in the conclusion.
That's such an academic, man. You're trying to quit content gray areas here.
Hey, listen, Paul. Look, I can't, you know, you can't nail down exactly, right, how each town and city does it and can do it uniformly. And that's kind of our biggest walk away, right, is that can we find some uniformity between these towns, right? And so we kind of mentioned that over and over again at the end. That was my big sticking point. And even the peer review said that. We probably overanalyzed it in terms of saying that, Paul. No. And I did. And it was a rightful concern. We kind of managed to go through. It's kind of an interesting process when you go through the peer review. from your colleagues at other universities and colleges, but we kind of hammered that and we wanted to stress that. And we said that obviously to Joe DeLong, you know, so that hopefully CCM can go back and revisit, hey, what are lessons learned in this? What kind of uniformity can take place? What kind of continuity can take place? Could there be a hybrid, as you're saying, Paul? And so I think, quite frankly, and Jody wanted to really emphasize this, that this is just the beginning point of assessing this. Hopefully, through these outcomes down the road, additional research could take place, because this is just the starting point, we think. Because look, this is going to continue on into the spring, right? And maybe people will be advocating for what you're saying, Paul. Have this more open, more online, but find a way of maybe universalizing it and make it some sense of continuity in the first place. So I'm hopeful that the towns will learn from each other and they communicate more effectively with each other and saying, what are the lessons learned and what can we do with each other? Which we know in Connecticut is a very difficult challenge because towns like to do it their way. And they don't oftentimes want to communicate with each other on how they
do it. So your point's well taken and your research shows it, that all towns are different. Seymour is different from New Haven, et cetera. But on the question of whether we should post-pandemic go to which of the three models, all in person like before, all online like now, or some hybrid, I would argue that that can't be tailored to each, that Connecticut does need a rule for that. Do you not agree with that? Do you really think we should say in Bantam, you don't have to show up, but in Cornwall you do, in New Haven, you could kind of be online and in person, but in Bridgeport you don't? You don't think there'd be a need for some kind of uniformity? Do you guys have any leanings toward that?
We didn't make those recommendations, but I know when we talked to Tom Hennick at the FOI Commission, they felt very strongly that there should always be an in-person component, which I tend to agree with. I mean, there should be some physical access to your public officials, right? Mm-hmm. Elected them to represent you, the public. But I can't get past how many more and new people had access to democracy, to their town and to what was going on and how we spend money through Zoom meetings. So I guess personally, I would say some hybrid approach would be the best way.
And I'm not going to push you to say exactly all the, because I don't think anyone knows exactly how a hybrid should work.
Yeah.
So you'd like to see some hybrid.
I'd like to see some access. And like, we've already seen that Fairfield was a good example. They were already broadcasting their meetings on, you know, through video on YouTube. But could we do more of that in more towns? And could we do more of that where there's actually live interaction with the public? It's not like I go on and watch it after. I can actually go on and from home participate in the meeting. I think that would open it up to many more people. And I think probably before COVID, we would have said it was too hard technically to do, but everybody's become so accustomed to this kind of communication now that I don't think you could argue that anymore, right?
There's no turning back.
If there's any good news. And I guess if I could put my home rule hat on, Paul, which I know you're going to hate me for.
I'll never hate you.
I know it, man, but you know this. I'd rather see the towns be the ones to get on board with this or not, and they make a decision. Whether they would continue with this online format. I would love for them to do it, frankly, just as a New Englander, but let the towns decide that because they should be the ones to say it. But of course, there could be some encouragement from, let's say, the state government like FOI and certainly CCM and saying, look, this is the way of doing it. Here are the best practices. We'll help you out with that, right? In my ideal world, I would love to see that going to Jody's main concern so that reporters, journalists, you know, certainly taxpayers and others can be a part of it remotely or in person.
So this is good. And as Jody brought up, there's a continuum. So you got CTN that already does all the state stuff live, but you can't weigh in. Now we have labor committee hearings where we could weigh in. You have C-SPAN nationally in New Haven. We have public access. But as Jody points out, the next question is it two-way? Mm-hmm. And they thought you couldn't do two-way, and now you could do two-way. What reactions, they say, talk about being peer-reviewed. What reactions have you folks had to this article you wrote based on your study on open budgetary meetings amid a pandemic?
The journal that we published it in is national, right? And most states and most communities are not like Connecticut. We're unique, I think in a good way, but it's not always easy for other states to see how that applies to them. So I think one of the main bits of feedback we got on our paper was How does this apply to others, right? How can someone in California take these same ideas and apply it to what's happening in their government? And so we made some tweaks and tried to make it a little bit more clear, like these are, Connecticut's a great place to study because there's so many examples, and then you can take what works for you and apply it in your own community, in your own state.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan?
Yeah, no, I would say we're certainly an anomaly. And as I kind of offered there, you know, the analysis portion of it was some of the comments that we you know, got some feedback on, and even the organization and structure of it initially in terms of what we provided in the opening, but certainly in the conclusion. And as I was offering up, Paul, that's partly my fault. I took the blame for overanalyzing and overassessing things with recommendations. But Paul, you know how I am. I tend to be a policy wonk. So, but of course, that's what you're dealing with, I guess, when you're dealing with a policy courses versus certainly journalism professors, which, hey, I respect. But I thought that was a fun thing about this project.
Is it fair to say that you two came away saying things changed and we're not going to be going all the way back? Is that a fair?
I think that's fair. I think in a good way, too. I mean, well, and as you said, I mean, I'm of the technology generation. I always want things to be online and be more accessible. And I think COVID forced that to happen. And so,
Jonathan, do you feel the same sense of optimism or sense that this pushed us to a period where we're going to rethink this?
I think so. But also, you know, what can we learn from all of this, right? I think a part of this is we have to take a step back and acknowledge the shortcomings and the problems and saying, okay, what are next steps? What are best practices? What can we do about this? Quite frankly, Paul, I'm hopeful that we can see additional studies in this area because a lot of these towns don't know what they're doing most times. And that's kind of the scariest part, right? And so I'd hope that they can respect that and be more learning, be more open in terms of what works and what doesn't work. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes we know in Connecticut, there's this resistance, right? We love to be this land of steady habits. I hate saying it, but you know, it's true. And so sometimes we just have to say, hey, to ourselves, what can we do better? And this is a great example of it for the starting point when it comes to open government.
You did have five specific recommendations. You want, as Jody talked about this, do a better job distributing teaching materials in advance, include virtual chats in the minutes. I love those kind of deep dive suggestions. Specifically invite the public to comment, engage the public outside the meeting to get new voices, and develop consistent methods to notify the public about meetings. So basically those kind of feel more like what Jody and Jonathan were thinking about 5 years ago, 10 years ago, when they sat in meetings about what needs to be better, and that this could sort of be a way to bring up issues like that.
Well, and I think Joe DeLong was talking about this when we interviewed him. We've kind of gotten into a mode of business as usual before COVID, and this really shook things up. So I think a lot of towns are evaluating how they do things. And so even if we do go back to some form of the old version, I hope that public officials use this moment to really reflect on like what is working and what's not working, and let's make it work better. Let's get more people involved. I mean, that's the whole point.
And also I would say, Paul, get more outsiders involved in this, right? I mean, yeah, a couple of academics like ourselves, a couple of reporters, maybe some gadflies, if you will, to kind of measure and study what have been the impacts of this. Let's throw in a couple of think tanks. Let's include CCM. I mean, I think getting more people there to give more reflective analysis could be very useful. And maybe some pathways of doing some online discussion groups and forums, and maybe even classes on how to deal with this, some of these areas for officials.
Well, you two have certainly started the ball rolling. One reason I've always been optimistic about government and politics of public engagement around here is because Jody Mosier-Gill, first as a reporter and now a professor at Southern Connecticut University, and Jonathan Wharton, former GOP town chair, active member in the party, and a political science professor. You two both do so much to promote these values and help us think about it and make it work. So thanks so much, everyone. The article is Open Budgetary Meetings Amid a Pandemic, Journal of Civic Information. We'll have an article about this in a day or two on The Independent. We'll have a link to the whole article so you can read the whole article. Thanks so much for joining us, folks. It's, you know, I wish you could be in person, but it's so nice to see you both and chat with you both. And thanks for making time to come on Dateline today.
Thank you. We appreciate it. Great questions, of course.
And thanks, everyone, for joining us. And thanks to Harry Drost, the general manager of WNHHFM, who makes it happen. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free. from the group's CD, A Plea for Peace. Paul Bass inviting you to fly free with us all day, on a ride long, on WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio. Thank you.